Noah Webster is remembered primarily for the dictionary that bears his name, but Joshua Kendall claims that his major contribution is Webster's largely forgotten role in forging this country's identity and helping to create and define a unique American culture. Mr. Kendall's new book, The Forgotten Founding Father, is published by Putnam, and I'm very pleased that it has brought him to our show. Hello.
Pleasure to be here, Leonard.
Now, your last book was about Peter Mark Roget, the author of The Thesaurus, so I'm assuming that one led to the other.
Yes. Noah Webster was a natural follow-up because we have a great American lexicographer that I could write about.
Well, is it just a coincidence that his dictionary was published in 1828 and the thesaurus just 25 years later?
Yes. The 19th century was the century of classification, and scholars around the world were starting to organize and compile words. So they were doing it in England and America and Germany. So that was kind of the first century of big dictionaries.
But were you surprised to discover in your research that he had relationships with the founding fathers?
Yes. Noah Webster is forgotten. I mean, I come from Boston, and in Boston, many people think Daniel Webster wrote the dictionary.
Just met the devil.
He was on Hollywood, and the devil and Daniel Webster actually led to Noah Webster's decline. And the point of my book is to put Noah back on the map and to remind everyone that he wrote the dictionary, and also to remind people that he was a founding father. When Noah Webster died in 1843, one historian said that he belonged in America's Trinity of Fame, along with Columbus and Washington. And he's had this what I call incredible shrinking reputation, the dictionary was actually the final project of his life, and in the 1780s he was right there at the founding of our nation.
But isn't it a bit of a stretch to call him a founding father? He didn't have the kind of achievement that Washington, Jefferson, or Madison had.
Yes, a founding father technically is defined as someone who signed the Declaration or the Constitution, but he was right there. And in 1785, after he wrote his Speller, and actually that's the book for which he was best known in his lifetime. In 1783, at the age of 25, he published a spelling book for school children, and that was the Harry Potter of its day.
It was a primer?
A primer, yeah. It sold 100 million copies between 1783 and 1900. And it educated five generations of American children. And in 1783 alone, it sold 5,000 copies in a country of 3 million. And that gave him a national reputation. And Webster was kind of a know-it-all, and he figured he knew everything. And sometimes he really did. And in 1785, he diagnosed what was wrong with America. He said the Articles of Confederation aren't working, and we need a new founding document. And he went right to George Washington and told George Washington what to do to fix the country, and Washington listened to him.
Well, part of the problem was that the Articles of Confederation were messing up his control of the rights of his book, right? He couldn't collect royalties.
Well, he did always have his eye on the marketplace, and there was a lot of piracy in the 1780s. And when his Speller came out, to make sure that sales would that he could have sales, he personally went to the state capital, to every state capital, and got copyright law passed. And he's considered the founding father of American copyright law. But then, when the Constitution was passed and the federal government had more authority, he did cash in. And in 1788, he's very excited that the Constitution is passing because he's a Federalist. But he also has his eye in the marketplace and negotiates new deals.
And you said it was the Harry Potter of the day. Is that because of the spells?
The Harry Potter, the sales and the success and the spelling, I guess.
Well, he was not Americanizing words at that point the way he did later with the dictionary.
Yes, he was Americanizing. Color was spelt with a U, but he was Americanizing because in the 1780s, our language was really up for grabs. If you think about it, English was the language of the oppressor. We had just gotten the king out of our face, and there was a serious discussion in America about what language we should speak.
And Ben Franklin thought Hebrew would have been a good language. Others proposed German?
German. German was then the Spanish of its day, spoken by about 10% of the people. And Webster, his idea in the 1780s was that we should speak American English. And he didn't tweak the color then, but the idea that that we don't need the license of Englishmen to come up with our own words, and that the speller used the names of American cities and towns, and the speller helped forge an American identity in the 1780s.
And also led to a fad of spelling bees, didn't it?
Yeah. The spelling bee was basically America's first spectator sport. Before there was baseball or horse racing, there were spelling bees, and New Englanders would stand out in the lawn and have these spell downs, and that was the speller was a national sensation.
Was spelling still fluid at that time?
Spelling was fluid in around 1700. Spelling was all a jumble. In Shakespeare, the same word is spelled differently. So there was some codification around 1700, but what Webster was trying to do in the speller was break down regional dialects. And if you think about it, that's his major achievement with both the speller and the dictionary, is that we're the most ethnically diverse nation on the face of the earth, but from Maine to Hawaii, we all speak the same language, American English. And if you go to old Europe, let's say France or Germany, every 20 miles or 20 kilometers, they speak a different dialect. But Webster broke down regional dialects with his speller and kind of nationalized our language.
He also went on a book tour. Was that the first book tour in this country?
Yes. He basically invented the sort of modern infrastructure of the publishing industry, that very infrastructure which is now threatened by the digital revolution. He got blurbs and he wrote articles, got press for his books when they came out. And he went on this book tour. And during his book tour, he also counted – he was an obsessive, as I argue. And during his book tour, he personally counted the houses of all the cities he visited, including New York.
When you say obsessive, he sounds OCD by modern thinking.
Yes.
He'd like to make lists and count things.
Yes. Psychiatry, they have two disorders that concern obsessionality. One is OCD per se. And people with OCD tend not to function very well because they're so anxious, they're afraid that they're going to burn the house down or something. And Webster didn't have that form of the disorder, but he had what contemporary psychiatrists call obsessive-compulsive personality disorder. And those people function better than well. And a dose of that can be very helpful. And he loved orders and lists and rules. And lexicography was a perfect fit for his disorder.
So did all of this make him wealthy?
He made a lot of money from the speller. And then he basically retired at the age of 40 to write the dictionary. Samuel Johnson, who had written the great English dictionary, once said, "No one but a blockhead ever wrote except for money." And he wrote the dictionary to make cash. But Webster wrote the dictionary because he loved doing it. And another way of looking at it is, for most of us, the task of writing a dictionary might drive us crazy, the task of writing a dictionary by ourselves. But for him, the task of writing a dictionary may well have prevented him from going crazy.
Was he at all inspired by what Samuel Johnson had done?
He had the very intense love-hate relationship with Samuel Johnson. When he was 20 years old and finishing up at Yale, he wanted to be a writer, and his father was a poor farmer, and his father couldn't support him. And his father gave him an $8 bill and said, "Son, you're on your own now." And he writes in his diary that he felt cast upon the world. And that weekend, he ends up locking himself up in his room with Samuel Johnson. And he decides that he wants to define words with the exactitude of Samuel Johnson. And Johnson was kind of a father figure for him.
My guest is Joshua Kendall, who's written The Forgotten Founding Father, Noah Webster's Obsession, and the Creation of an American Culture. It's published by Putnam. I know you said that he made money from the speller, but wasn't he kind of living off of the generosity of his brother-in-law at that time? Let's go back a bit.
Sure.
So what kind of pedigree did his family have?
The family had a fancy pedigree, and they were in America right around Webster was a governor of Connecticut in the 17th century. But his father was a poor farmer, kind of a middle-class farmer, and the American economy wasn't doing so well in the 1760s and 1770s.
And his father hadn't gone to college.
And his father hadn't gone to college, but he mortgaged the farm to send Webster to Yale. And he was the one of he had three brothers, and one brother who went to Yale, and his other brothers led kind of poor and miserable lives. But his Yale education changed everything.
Did he was coming out of a rather poor situation. So how did he even prepare to go to Yale?
He was tutored by the pastor of the town, and he prepared him in Latin and Greek. And that pastor was an influential, another kind of father figure.
At the time, did Yale have the reputation of being a bastion of wealth and power?
Yale was then kind of a Bible college. And it was just starting to had about four professors, and most of the students would go into the ministry. And just in the 1770s, when Webster got there, was when they started to focus on the liberal arts.
And it became a little more egalitarian as
yes,
well.
Yes, yeah.
He was influenced by a young professor named Timothy Dwight.
Yes, Timothy Dwight. I went to Yale, and I liked it. When I go back there, I say that Webster was there back in the day when the residential colleges were all people. Timothy Dwight is one of the residential colleges, and he later became a Yale president. And in 1776, he was a tutor. He gave this influential speech that really roused Webster and other Yaleys about that America was this new country and that Yaleys could contribute to its greatness.
So what did they do, quit and join the Army?
Some of them quit and joined the Army. When Webster was a freshman, he was a member of the Yale militia, and he personally greeted George Washington. But Webster loved Yale and wanted to be a writer, but the problem was that America's economy was in the toilet in the 1770s. There was hyperinflation, and he became a school teacher after Yale. And then he wrote The Speller because he had noticed that the school children were using an English textbook, and he decided to write The Speller, and that led to a cash flow. But as you say, he wasn't wealthy right away. In the 1780s, even though the copyright law was passed, he didn't have great deals, and his publishers made out much better than he did. And he was also trained as a lawyer. In those days, you had to train under a full-fledged lawyer for a couple of years, and he did that, but he couldn't find a job as a lawyer. So he had the same career path as Peter Mark Roget, which was he decided to marry rich. Mm. And he marries Rebecca Greenleaf, who comes from a very prominent Boston family. And Rebecca had a rich brother who was kind of the Bernie Madoff of his day. He was a speculator. And in the late 1780s, he was doing very well. And his job was he got contracts in the early 1790s to build Washington, D.C. After Webster married his sister. And he had a lot of money then. And he gave Webster the money to get married. But then things didn't go so well for James Greenleaf in the 1790s, and he was thrown into the Prune Street prison in Philadelphia.
Now, there was a popular spelling book by the Reverend Dilworth when Webster came up with his. What did Webster give us that Reverend Dilworth didn't?
Webster gave it this American flavor. Dilworth died in 1780, and Webster also, although he was kind of crotchety and had trouble connecting with other people, he could always connect with his readers, and it was just very clear and straightforward and easy to follow, and the kids could learn very easily. And in all his books, he had this remarkable knack for really connecting with the reader in a really useful way, and that also comes out later in the dictionary.
And he also came up with a media campaign.
Yes.
But there were objections. There was a man who called himself the Ghost.
Yes, and he had a knack for publicity, so he writes this Speller, and then a fellow named the Ghost attacks it and says, Dilworth's is fine, why do we need this other Speller? But Webster had a knack for publicity, and he realized that the more the Ghost attacked him, the better sales would be. So he loved the controversy and wrote a lot of letters to try to get the Ghost to respond, because every time the Ghost piped up, Webster would make more money.
We know who the Ghost is?
The Ghost, the identity isn't clear. There are a couple of theories, some rattled school teacher in New England.
But then Webster began writing editorials addressed to the American people.
Yes.
Did he see himself as a patriot? Or
yes,
was
he
this,
saw himself as a, as
this
a patriot.
This was not opportunism.
Well, I think it was both. And I think that's the kind of the story of my book, is that Webster, it's always both and. He both had a form of mental illness and was a great contributor. He was both a patriot and a marketing genius.
And you said that he was counting his way across America.
Yes. So in each of the towns that for his book tour, he did a personal house count. And Philadelphia was the largest city, and it had 4582. but he liked round numbers, so he rounds it off to 4,600. And those data were later folded into the first census of 1790.
The French ambassador, Edmond Genet, was trying to drag America into a war with England at the time.
Yes. And
this is after the Revolution?
Yeah, this is in 1793.
This is before the War of 1812.
Right. So this is
to divert England from its wars with France?
Yeah. And so Genet is trying to get the Jeffersonians in America to ally with France in a war against England. And Webster had forged a relationship with George Washington in the 1780s. He had been down to Mount Vernon to talk about the Constitution. When Washington is at the Constitutional Convention, the first thing he does is knock on Webster's hotel room door in Philadelphia. And in 1793, Genet was trying to get the Americans involved in a war, and Washington wanted to stay neutral. So Washington calls on his right-hand man, Webster, and Webster comes down to here to Lower Manhattan to start New York City's first daily newspaper. And that newspaper was called the American Minerva. Alexander Hamilton wrote for that newspaper. And the New York Post, the oldest continuous published daily, starts in 1801 because Webster and Hamilton have a fight, and that's the split in the Federalist Party that leads to the election of Jefferson in 1800.
What was the fight over?
The fight was...
I usually side with Hamilton in these things.
Yeah. It was just about kind of positioning themselves against the Jeffersonians, and they had different takes on how to go after Jefferson.
So how long did the Minerva last?
The Minerva, in various forms, lasted until 1930. So the New York Post is the oldest continuously published daily, but Webster's daily is older.
Then how did he come up with the idea of creating a dictionary and changing the spelling of many words?
Yes. So in 1798, he retires, and he moves to New Haven, and he moves into Benedict Arnold's house in New Haven. He gets a good deal because it's tainted by shame. It's the fanciest house in New Haven, and he wants to write the dictionary, but he actually writes one project before that. He wrote a book before that, which is a treatise on the yellow fever. In the 1790s, the yellow fever had literally decimated Philadelphia. For instance, in 1793, 5,000 people in Philadelphia died, and Webster loves crunching numbers. And he crunches death statistics and writes what he calls a brief treatise on the yellow fever. And brief for Webster means 700 pages. And scholars William Osler, a physician at Johns Hopkins, has said that that was one of the most important books ever written by a layman on medicine. He says that around 1900. And after he does that, he's ready to do the dictionary. And again, that's his retirement project, and that's what he loves to do. But he has to take on Samuel Johnson and Samuel Johnson Jr. Now, if a publicist were to come up with a good name for a dictionary maker, a pen name, it would be Samuel Johnson Jr., but there was actually such a fellow, and he was a Connecticut guy who had written the first American dictionary in 1798. And that dictionary looks like a modern-day thesaurus. It has one-word definitions. So in 1806, Webster takes on Johnson Jr. by writing a compendious dictionary or brief dictionary with one-word definitions, and then he spends the next 22 years working on his big dictionary to replace Johnson. And in that part of the book, I make a joke that writing a dictionary, as Webster repeatedly learned, takes longer than expected. He first thought 5, 10, and then it took 22 years.
Were his definitions significantly different from those in other dictionaries at the time?
The latest version of Johnson's dictionary had about 58,000 words. Webster adds a lot of words, and many of the words that he adds are from science. Johnson had the soul of a poet, and Webster had a kind of scientific mind, and he's reading widely in the sciences of the Enlightenment and underlining words, and he's adding words from physics and chemistry and the like. A scholar has looked at the two dictionaries and said that Webster takes about a third of his definitions from Johnson, but lexicographers were always stealing from one another, so a third isn't really that much.
Well, when we look at the Merriam-Webster Dictionary of today, do we still find some of the original definitions?
They're really not there. I mean, Webster's dictionary was part autobiography. It was sort of a first stab. For instance, in 1808, Webster becomes a born-again Christian. So he's going to define marriage as a covenant between man, woman, and God. And the Merriam-Webster is going to make a major revision in 1864 that turns it into an objective dictionary that we could recognize today.
He also seems to have predicted global warming.
Yes.
This guy was all over the place.
Yeah, it's remarkable. Any of these sort of side achievements would be a lifetime achievement for anyone else. He hated Thomas Jefferson, and he took on Thomas Jefferson on global warming. And again, that paper, and in those days, obviously, there weren't cars, but the issue at hand was the deforestation of states like Vermont. And Webster argued that it wasn't really making that much of a difference. And he was proved correct on that score.
He was just getting his data from at that time, I would think, sources that weren't all that reliable.
Yeah. Again, these early scientific works, like the work on epidemics, the data aren't great. But Webster's doing what he can, and that's a passion that he and Thomas Jefferson shared. Both of them loved to take the temperature.
He was a bit of an elitist. He suggested that the vote should only be available to people over the age of 45.
Yeah. Well, he was very crotchety, and he says all of these ridiculous things. And he says that when he's about to turn 50. So
he would have voted then.
Yeah, he would have voted. Yep.
Joshua Kendall will be speaking at the New York Public Library tonight at 6 o'clock. That's on Fifth Avenue and 42nd Street. The book, The Forgotten Founding Father, Noah Webster's Obsession and the Creation of an American Culture. It's published by Putnam, which was established around the same time, just a few years after Webster came up with his dictionary.
That's right.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure.